Accession number 18834, Reel 4.
Hull Kerridge, Reel 4. Yes, talking of relationships and other sort of groups, did you meet other nationalities at the front ever, apart from the British? You know, did you come into contact with French troops or any of the Australians?
Not as a fighting force. I met several Australians and that sort of thing when I was down in the base camps. And we got on very well because the Australians are a bloodthirsty lot, you know, rough and ready. And they matched up the Scots beautifully. So Australia and the Scots got on well together. So I knew quite a few Australians there, you know, on and off, only casual acquaintances. They're about the only ones I ever... Oh, and a couple of Canadians I knew out there too.
Did you think when the Americans entered the war? Was that any big thing, 1917, when America came in the war?
Well, let's be perfectly honest about it. They didn't do any fighting, but they frightened the Germans to death. Because the Germans were on their last legs. We'd almost beaten them on our own. And as I say, they were down to the dregs when we were at them. They were calling up the boys. And there was one German there. He got a couple of stripes in his arm. I don't know what they call them in Germany, whether he was a corporal or what the hell he was. But he was a non-commissioned officer of sorts. And like most Germans, he spoke English of a sort, but he spoke quite educated English, and he was honest about it. And I was chatting to him one day, and he said, you know, we've lost this war. I said, you're telling me? I know you've lost it. I knew that from the day we started it, because I said, you know, the British, we don't give in. So then he was saying that he said, really, it's what put paid to us. He said, when we knew that the Americans were coming over with all their modern equipment and their tens of thousands of new men, we knew we'd had it. So really, it was the Americans who frightened them into submission. We started them on the run. It would have probably taken some other 6 months or more before we'd killed the louse, as we might say.
But did you respect them as fighting troops, you know, during the earlier years of the war? Were they respected, do you think, the Germans?
Were the Germans respected as fighting troops? The Germans were excellent fighting troops. No doubt about it. The Germans are a good fighting man. In a way, it's build up a spirit of the Prussian element. A Prussian is an aggressive man anyway. Every country, I think, is purely opinion, every country has its characteristic. The French, they have their little tiny shrug of the shoulders will tell you everything. The Italians are very much similar, but the shrug of the shoulders a bit more of evident. And the Germans, they use their hands, they use everything. I'm telling you, now, that's the Germans, their arms are flying about and they're at you like that, you know. And that's the Prussian element. And that is the German when he's his mode of argument. And then none of them understand the British, because we as an island nation, if we've got any characteristic at all, they're very, very, very modified, and they're only picked up from a little bit of French and a little bit of Italian. None of the British, none of the German, because we are not an aggressive nation.
Did you actually have to fight hand-to-hand combat ever, face-to-face with Germans?
That's the one thing I was always pleased about, and that is when I got finally knocked out. In battle, you're taught to kill. You know, you've got machine guns flying out, bullets flying everywhere, lumps of metal, shrapnel flying everywhere. You accept all that. But there's the one thing that I never, never wanted. I hoped I would never come face to face with a German and have to stick a bayonet in him, or he in turn would stick a bayonet in me. And by good luck, or call it what you will, I got knocked out before we got to the German trenches. So I never had the option of being stabbed or stabbed or stabbing somebody else, thank God. I never wanted that.
Would you have been at the front during the march advance of the Germans, when they advanced in March 1918? Would you have been there at that time? This would, of course, been before the La Bassée operation, wouldn't it? When they made that big push in March 1918, and the British retreated.
Would
you have been in the front at that time, part of the retreat?
Oh, well, we'd been in a retreat the whole time. We were gradually being pushed back. You can say what you like about the archives and that sort of thing, about having lost a bit of territory and removed to more strategic positions and that. We were not. We were well and truly beaten. Beaten by an overwhelming force. And that was the Germans. They pushed us back, and they pushed us back, and they pushed us back again. And every time we tried to counterattack, they counterattacked against us and pushed us further back. Until we got within sight of the Channel ports. I tell you, we're on the banks of the Somme, where you could damn near see the Channel ports. And then somebody high up somewhere, who was in charge of the battles at that time, it was Lloyd George or somebody like that, they said, well, this is where we've got to make a stand. We can't go any further back, because we're in sight of the French Channel ports. And if they take the French Channel ports, they'll damn soon take ours. So we've got to make a stand here and fight it out. And that's why we got stuck on the Somme. And that's why we, so it was backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards over the years. We just slogged it out. And you can imagine what the terrain must have been like, you know, with 2 years of intense bombardment from both sides. Because make no mistake about it, the Germans had everything. At one stage, for every shell that we fired, they fired a dozen. Oh, we were overwhelmed, there's no doubt about that. I think it was, must have been Lloyd George's time at some time. Because I know in the, I suppose it was some issue that was put forward by the high up in the Parliament or somebody, said the lads want shells, they're all grumbling because they don't get enough shells. Right, you shall have shells. So they removed all this, whoever it was, removed all restrictions about women labour, said you can employ women wherever you like and whatever you like, whatever they're capable of doing. Put them into shell factories. And that's where we started to get shells and shells and more and more and more shells. And they were a saviour, they really were. Because if they hadn't removed those restrictions about the employment of women labour, we'd have been in trouble. No, the women of those days, they play their full part. They were good.
Aircraft did you see at the front?
Practically none, because aircraft was in its infantry. All you got was a few of these old sort of farm and biplanes sort of thing. They were mostly observation, that's all, to take photographs of where the German lines were on that, and they got shot down one after another. But as fighting planes, no. There were no such things. No, they were just observation planes, that's all.
And were there many balloons used, observation balloons?
Never saw them at all, no, never saw any of those. They may have had some further along the French lines, I wouldn't know. They may have had some blimps and that sort of thing, but I never saw any of them. No, I'm afraid that the part of the line which we took over, which was all the northern France there. The French left us to it there. And they were glad to get out of it and say, well, let the British look after it. It's nearest their ports. So they cleared off down south very wisely and left us to it. So in a way, although we were in France, it was still like being in England. Because whoever you spoke to and wherever you went, it was English everywhere. There's no French at all, no French spoken.
You were always in that part, were you? Northern France. The northern French-Belgian part of the line, was it?
Yes, well, we started right in the earliest days, of which I knew little. I was still at school. I think we started out actually in Belgium, a place called Mons. And from Mons, we gradually drifted further and further down south until we got down to Bethune and all around that part of the world, and Hazelbrook and round about there. And we gradually drifted further and further south until we were right down as far as Chateau Thierry, which was, I'm trying to remember my French map now, which I suppose is not very far from Dieppe. No, anyway, it's where the Somme enters itself into the sea. It's getting on towards Chateau Thierry, around that part of the world. It's very near where the Americans were in the Second World War. Hmm. So we drifted along the line right the way from the Belgian border right the way down, up and down. One of the battalions, either London Scottish or the Gordon Highlanders. What a mere hammer. Quite a big mixed view one way or another.
Has your wound bothered you at all, your war wound in the back? You know, have you had to have pensions or compensation for it?
No. No, they've all healed up as they would do over the years, and that's one good thing about normal wounds. That given time, they heal and you're as good as new. But if you're out in Burma or somewhere like that, and you get a dose of beriberi or something, it's with you for life. No, so all the wounds that I had, and I was wounded a couple of times, they're only sort of superficial wounds that took time to heal, but once they were healed, that was it. No different from being in a bad car accident or anything like that.
You were saying how after the war, you know, you realised 2 years later you had been adapting from this state of very high tension to the normal civilian life. How long do you reckon it took you to fully adapt?
I don't know. That was purely my own theory. Because I say, about 2 years after, I suddenly was walking through the park one day and I thought, God, what's the matter with me after the war? Mooching about around the park on like that on my own. I must have been crazy. And I suddenly came to me then. I thought, well, I don't know. I suppose it was normal. After having had years and years of bang and bluster in the trenches and all that sort of thing. And I'd grown up then, I was 19. Now I got powers of thinking for myself. I was no longer a schoolboy. I'd learned a lot. And I suddenly realised then, I thought, well, I suppose there's a reason for it. And that was my theory and my reason. I might be wrong.
Of course, there was no counselling in your day, was there?
Oh, no.
In those times, no. Would it have helped, do you think, if there had been someone to have sort of counselled soldiers at the end of their service?
I don't think it would have mattered. I don't know. No, the great thing then, I think, was to let the demob soldier alone, let him find his own feet again. Treat him kindly and be tolerant and let him find his own feet again.
The actual armistice. This is going back to the end of the war.
And I was. When that was signed, I was at Vimera. Nothing special about it. I know myself and a couple of other lads. We were about, I think it was about 3 miles from Boulogne. We went in Boulogne, had a few drinks, that's all, and drifted back to camp again. And accept it as part and parcel of the daily routine. It's the end of the war, and that was it. We knew it was coming. And we knew it was coming, all right. We'd been expecting it all the, for days and days we'd been expecting it.
Did you find it easy when you went back to civilian work to settle, you know, to a civilian job?
Very difficult indeed, because you joined the army as a schoolboy knowing nothing, and you came out of the army knowing even less. Even you'd forgotten a lot of your schoolboy, a lot of your school knowledge you'd forgotten, and you had to start from nothing. And you had to realize, in those days, there was no such a thing as Minister of Labour, no dole, nothing. You earned money, or you starved. And then you've probably read about it, you've seen captains and what have you, in Oxford Street selling matches. Having held a commission didn't mean a thing. You had to take anything that was going, whether it was a salary or there was money to it. I knew one chap in particular who had been an accountant to a very big firm. And when he came out of it, he couldn't get a job for any money or anything like that. He got a nice house, and he finished up with a pair of shears knocking him door to door, "Can I clip your hedges for two bob?" He had to do it. As he explained, he said, "I've got to earn money. And if I can't be an accountant, I must do what I can do."
What happened to you, Hal?
I got various temporary jobs. Bits and pieces jobs. As I say, I knew less. I was really speaking. The only jobs I could get were sort of office boys' jobs. I tried a couple of those things with a little insurance company, and that didn't go on too well. Then what the hell happened to me? Oh, then yes, then I decided that there was no future in this country. I thought I'd better go abroad somewhere. So it was a question of whether I went to Australia or Canada. And I thought, well, Canada's a bit nearer than Australia. So I made up my mind I'd probably go to Canada. So we went out to town, another fellow and I went up to town to do a Canadian house and asked me to put on a rota, because at that time they were giving you a grant of X number of pounds and the guarantee of a job when you got to Canada. Well, thank goodness I had 3 years' quota. So I said, well, I'm not waiting for 3 years. So that killed that. And thank goodness it did, because the jobs they had out there was just lumber jobs. So that killed that. So I scratched around and got various odd jobs here and there, and as I say, earned a bob or two here and there where I could. And I finished up with Morris Motors in the motor industry. And I spent 15 or 16 years with them until the Second War started.
Did you have any part in that?
Any?
In the Second War? Did you, were you involved in any way?
Yes, very much so. First of all, when the Second World War started, I was sales manager of one of the biggest companies in London. I had 14 depots to look after. I had a sales staff of about 150, indoors and outdoors.
This would be Morris Motors?
Oh, it was a part of Stuart Nodden, which was an offshoot of Morris Motors. So when the Second World War started, of course, immediately they cut down all production of motor cars. So all the salesmen had to go, and then the sales manager had to go. So I was back at square one. I had a little capital by then, of course, but nothing to speak of. So I took myself into a quiet corner. I thought, well, what the hell can I do now? There's nothing in the motor industry that I can do. It's quite useless, that is. Where's your knowledge? Where's your knowledge to earn money? And it suddenly struck me. I thought, well, damn it all. I spent years and years in the army. I know the army inside out. I'd been invaluable bloke for training, same as my brother was. So, damn it, I'll join the army. So I, at that time, I belonged to a tennis club, and there was a fellow in the tennis club who was in the War Office. So I said to him one day, I said, here, look, how do I go to apply for a commission? Oh, he said, I mean, it's in my section. He said, I can get fixed that for you. So anyways, he did. He fixed that for an audition, if you like to call it such, at Howard's Hotel in London for a commission. So I trips up to London, go into Howard's Hotel, go into a boardroom there where there were two colonels, or a major and a colonel, and a chap in civvies. And the chap in civvies, I don't know what he was, but he was higher than the other two. He was the kingpin there, although he wasn't wearing a uniform. Anyway, they started asking me a few odd questions, and then they suddenly found that I'd been in the First World War, you see. Because they had to ask me what I had been doing and all the rest of it. And from then onward, I realised that none of these chaps had seen a war. They didn't know the first thing about it, you see. So instead of them interviewing me for a commission, I was giving them a lecture about the First World War. So in the end, we finished up. We were all good pals together. We were all chatting together, this, that and the other, and they wanted to know all about the First World War, as you're asking now, and that sort of thing. So in the end, this civilian chap, whoever he was, he said to me, he says, look, old man, he said, you've done your share. He said, let the youngsters have a go. He said, in any case, he'd be in for a dig. He said, with your knowledge and what you've seen and what you've done in the First World War, to be ordered about by some little pipsqueak with one pip on his shoulder, he said, that would hurt. And he said, you'd have to start that way. He said, no, forget it. He said, we've got your name down here now. He said, if we can make use of you later on, we'll get in touch with you. We've got you on record. So we all finished up and good friends. We shook hands and that was that. About 6 weeks afterwards, I had a phone call from a chap named George Bryan, who I knew very, very well indeed in the motor industry. He said, Hal, he said, thank God we got in touch with you. What have you been doing with yourself? Where are you? So I told him all about it, and I'd worked with George and with another chap named Norman Collins, who's in the book there. I worked in there about 15 years in the motor industry. And they said, God, you're the man we want. They said, we've just the man we want. He said, why don't come out and have a lunch? So I said, what's all this in aid of? What are you doing? He said, well, we're now in the Minister of Supply, and we've got to organise the whole of the motor trade on tanks and transport. So I said, I'm with you, I'll come and have lunch with you. So I did, I went and had lunch with him. The next thing is, I find that I was surprised, told off to report to the Minister of Supply. So I went up there and I got appointed there as an engineer in the Ministry of Supply, and I was not an engineer anyway, but anyway, I knew how to handle staff. I'd handle big staff and that sort of thing. And I finished up with the Minister of Supply. I spent years and years with them, and I finished up as an assistant director, which in military terms was about lieutenant colonel.
What were you doing in the war? You know, what was the job? Were you dealing with the supply of vehicles?
Well, we were supplied for the maintenance of tanks and transport. But of course, all vehicles broke down, and we had to use the reserves of the motor trade, if you like, collate them together for the repair and maintenance of the tanks and transport. And tank transport included everything from Bren gun carriers to trailers or anything on wheels. And I had depots all over the country. And from then onwards, they found that they'd been impressing a lot of ridiculous vehicles that they wanted to get rid of, and they started a disposal section. So they dropped on me occasionally, straight away. They got no mercy, I tell you, no mercy in the ministry. He came to me one day and said, we want you on disposals. How do you feel about it? I said, well, what sort of disposals and where are they and what do you want me to do? He said, well, it's up to you to find out where they are. You'll have to contact the military and find out. So, you willing to take it over? Well, I'll never say no to anything. I said, of course I am. So I took over the disposal side. And I finished up. I had depots all over the country. And the war finished and gradually ran down. The maintenance and that sort of thing gradually ran down. Until it came to the time when I was only on temporary staff, mind you, for the duration of the Second World War. For my son's sins, they came to me one day. I said, would you like to stop on in the ministry? He said, you're, what was I then, 40-something or other, 50 or something or other. So I thought to myself, well, damn it all, I don't want to go out again now and start the bottom of the ladder once again. So I said, yes, I don't mind the ministry. It's in some sort of capacity. What do you want me to do? So they said, well, that's an open field. So I agreed to stay on the ministry and offered me a permanency.
What was the, how effective was it in the war, in World War Two? You know, the Ministry of Supply regarding vehicles. Did the system work well of, you know, the replacements for the tanks and other vehicles? Did you have to cannibalise a lot of stuff?
Oh, yes, there was a lot of that done. And you see, the army, prodigious in its waste as ever, like they all are, terrific things that broke down, now they ditch it and get a new one. So a lot of those things were repairable, and we put them back into the old motor trade, which I knew Mater said. So we put them in for repair, and then they would go back into service, and they go back into, we used to supply the fire service and ambulance service, and all those people would supply more with vehicles. Some of them even went back to the army. And what we call the real junk, we used to put up for auction sales, and they used to put them, sell them by auction. And that's how we got rid of all the old army junk.
So you had a role in World War Two as well as World War
I. Oh, I did indeed.
Yes.
I spent all my time in London. I went all through the London bombing. And in those days, of course, if you had a senior job, time was no factor. So I'd probably be up in Northampton or somewhere like that at 10, 11 o'clock at night, get in the car, wretched heart, travel the lights, you know, those awful lights we had there, travel back to London, get about 2 or 3 hours sleep and back in the office in London again by 9 o'clock in the morning. And that's how we carried on for years.
Yes, you went through two world wars, didn't you?
Yes.
Against the Germans.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I have a taste of it all. I don't regret a minute of it.
You look very fit, Hal, at your ripe age of, what is it, 101?
I'll be 101 September.
101, that's wonderful. You don't look a day over 70. It's disgusting. But thank you ever so much for telling me so much about your World War One and World War Two experience.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I've kept you talking. Would you like a coffee or something?
I would love a cup of tea.